So my pleasure today is to introduce Harry. Harry Burton's well known to many of the Salt Springers, maybe to all of you actually, that's why you all came. He's the historian of apples in Salt Spring Island. He's been around for Salt Spring for a long time. Last time he was here, he spoke to us on the Ruckel family history. He's part of an organizer, and I guess founder of the Apple Festival, a highly successful agricultural festival each year on Salt Spring. So, Harry, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the Historical Society. We look forward to your presentation today. Thank you.
There's actually so much information available that one of my hopefully tasks this time is get it organized. So I'm going to have a slideshow in about 15 minutes here, and it's not exactly coordinated with my talk, but that's life. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a few things up here on the front first before I get into the history. This itself is apple history right here. This is a bowl made from apple wood. It was made by Geordie Webster, who's not actually doing bowls anymore. It's cut out of the tree in this shape. So when you cut the wood out, this is the direction that it is. But that's 13 and a half inches. And where do you get an apple tree that's that big, except on Salt Spring? I've got one right now that is from the first farm when Salt Spring has started in 1860. It's a log that just came down, and I'm hoping to get that and do a timeline, in other words, the slab, and do a timeline that where you can actually go back and trace the dates and maybe find out exactly when that tree was planted. But what you want to do is you don't want to dry those things up too fast, so we're working on that slowly. The other thing I've got here is one of my treasures. This is a book from 1876. It was from Henry Ruckel, and I got it through his granddaughter-in-law, which is Lotus, and she said, you need this book. And it's basically done by two brothers, the Downey brothers in the United States, where they list every apple variety that exists in the United States at that time. And it's one of the two incredible apple books that exist in the United States. So that is a real treasure, and I'd like to think that Henry Ruckel planted his orchard using that book. The other thing we've got here is a poster we've made up through the Apple Festival. This is actually, this is a poster of 60 of the favorite apples from Salt Spring. We canvassed all the farmers on Salt Spring to get their favorite varieties, and then we had an incredible artist from Victoria do a 50% reduction. So each of these apples are 50% of the size of the regular apple. And we put them together, 60 apples, and we sell these for $20, and all the money goes to Solid, which is sending money to South Africa, and so that's one of the things that the Apple Festival sponsors every year. Okay, let's get into this incredible history. So this is basically the whole apple history from 1860 onwards. Not much has changed in Salt Spring in 95 years. This is not a posed picture. I've got rubber wheels, he's got metal. He's got wooden boxes, I've got plastic boxes. I've got color photographs, he's got black and white. That's about it. He's getting roughly 2 cents a pound for apples. I'm getting, in Victoria, getting 2.50 a pound. So there's about 100... over 100 times more coming in financially. Now, let's talk a little more seriously about the things that are still the same. Four of the major difficulties that used to exist and still exist in farming on Salt Spring. Number one is farm labor. Difficult to get then and difficult to get now. And what happened in a lot of cases, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, is the ethnic folk, such as the Japanese and the natives, were able to be purchased cheaper, so they were the ones that used a lot of the real hard labor. And they were getting maybe $1.50 to $2 a day for labor. Number two challenge is transportation. It was a challenge then, and it's still a challenge now to connect with, let's say, those incredible markets in Vancouver. I connect with Victoria, but Vancouver is even more difficult. Number three, farming on Salt Spring has always been very hard work then, and it's still very hard work. And no farmers then, no farmers now are making much money at it. So I call it really, in both cases, you're taking a vow of poverty if you choose farming. I have a quote from 1930s from a Mr. Burkett who ran a fishing camp on St. Mary's Lake. When people came to him and went on and on about how great it was living on Salt Spring, he says, "True, true, we do have a wonderful life on this island. All we lack is money and the time to enjoy it." Now, a little bit of background information before we get started. All apples came from an incredible valley on the border between China and Kazakhstan. And that valley still exists, and it still has an incredible diversity of apples growing on trees that are, you know, 40 feet tall. And the DNA in those apples are exactly the same as the DNA in a Granny Smith or an apple you pick up downtown. So nothing has changed. What happened there is that basically the Silk Road out of China brought apples and, much more important, the seeds along that Silk Road eventually to England. And the seeds that got scattered along the way were what allowed apples to migrate slowly over time to Europe. And that happened in about the 1800s. Apples were happening in Europe. And then the travelers coming to North America in the 1800s brought the apple seeds and the science with them. An interesting thing here is that it's stated that apples didn't gain diversity over time. They had the diversity right from the beginning. And apples actually have twice the number of genes on their DNA that humans do. So therefore, when they cross, the diversity is just incredible. Something you can't imagine, the diversity. All apples need pollination. They need pollen from another tree, and that would be, if you considered the idea of the pollen being a male bringing DNA over to the flower, that's how you get the combination of DNA, and that's why an apple grown from seed is never equal to what the apple on the tree was. And so if you want to create a new apple tree, you plant a seed, and it will be different. The odds are it won't be as good as the tree it came from, but that's how you create new apples. And all the research people can do is to maybe control which pollen gets to that to try to make a better parent, to make a better cross. So if you want to create a new apple tree, you actually have to plant a seed. If you're trying to propagate an exact variety, then you graft. And that's exactly what I'm doing on Salt Spring and a few other people, where you take a piece off a tree and you graft it onto a rootstock, and then you get an exact copy of the tree. It's like a vegetative clone. Johnny Appleseed was a real person, and he was taking seeds from an apple pressing facility and scattering them all over the country. And just by the number he did, he created, him and other people like him, created an incredible diversity that guaranteed that a few of those were going to be incredible apple trees. In the United States, based on the work of people like Johnny Appleseed, has an incredible diversity of apples that happened in the 1800s. On Salt Spring, we had two types of apple farmers. We had people such as Trage and the commercial growers that grew thousands up to 1,500 apple trees. And then we had every other farm on the island. Every farm that existed always put in apple trees because apples were one of the staple foods that you could count on. Even if they weren't selling them, they at least had them in their food supply for their own type of people. We'll talk about two different types of those growers when we get going. Generally speaking, Salt Spring started about 1860 with Theodore Trage. We'll talk a little bit about him in the future. And then It takes about 5 years for an apple to start producing. So nothing happened right at the beginning until you got those trees rolling. And they might produce after 5, but they don't really produce much until they get to be 8 or 10 years old. So it turns out all the growers that were coming in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s, which is when most of our commercial growers came here, they didn't really hit good production until about 1900. And that was the peak of the apple growing on Salt Spring. So it peaked about, let's say, 1900. And then what happened, a couple things came to sort of sabotage us. We were supplying almost all the apples for British Columbia in those years. Now, we didn't have a lot of area, so we could never supply a big population, but we could supply what was needed in British Columbia at the time. Then a couple things happened. The Okanagan at that point didn't have rural electricity, so they had no irrigation. And the Okanagan needs irrigation because it's so much hotter and drier than we are. We, the type of trees we grow in Salt Spring don't need irrigation, and that's, I think, producing even a better tasting apple. But nevertheless, when the Okanagan started getting that rural electricity, they could irrigate, and so about 1920, the Okanagan basically took over and never looked back, and they are now the main apple-producing area in British Columbia. The other thing that happened, and it's really obvious reading Mort Stratton's book that I just got a hold of, was that the effect of the war, during the war, a couple things happened. First of all, a lot of the men went off to war. Some of them didn't come back. It created real hardships. And then after the war, it was almost like a mini depression. And then that kept going and really hit in 29 when the depression. So those were amazingly hard times on Salt Spring. And in the 30s, Ruckels were even pulling out some of their apple trees because there wasn't a real market for it. So that was basically Salt Spring's heyday was about 1890 to 1900, and we were supplying apples to basically all of British Columbia. And we'll talk about some anecdotes from that right now. So some of the growers that I'm going to mention now, these are the commercial growers. You can guarantee that any farm existing on Salt Spring had apple trees. They might have only had 10 or 20. Just enough to do them. But these are the commercial growers. So Traege would be number one. He started about 1860 and he had about 1,600 trees. Pappenberger, which is exactly the farm right next door to Ruckel, just as you're going down in the Ruckel farm, it started about 1870. Henry Ruckel, 1872. Mr. Purdy, which is grandfather to Don right here. I love his name. It was Raffles Augustus Robert Purdy. And he started here about 1884. And everybody here knows this place because if you drive down Bettis and find that barn in the middle of the road, that's his farm. Samuel Bettis, at the end of Bettis, right near Bettis Beach, started about 1885. And they were family related, Purdy's and the Bettises. Mr. Bullock, about 1892. Mr. Scott, 1892. Mr. Hamilton, which you probably don't know, but we'll talk about him a little bit later. He was out along Isabella Point at Fern Creek Farm. And then probably the land I'm on right now was Mr. Monk's land, and that was 1904. So that was basically the timeline of all those commercial growers that started on Salt Spring. And the other thing that those growers did is, in those days, they had diversity, which you couldn't believe. And I have a list of all the different growers here. They all had, they had some of the standard varieties like King and Wolf River, but boy, they had other incredible varieties. So I'm not sure what induced those farmers to grow diversity, but they sure realized that diversity was important. Another one, by the way, is Canada Rennet. So they were all very important. Mr. Hamilton, that I just mentioned, was the only one to create a Salt Spring apple variety, and he he crossed a wealthy and a king and came up with an apple called Millionaire. So that is an apple variety from Salzburg. Okay, I think to get some concrete ideas on this, I'm going to do a little slideshow now. And after that, I'll get back and we'll talk about all this continued history. Okay, so this is Will Scott, and we'll show a picture of his farm a little bit later. This is Theodore Trege, and I found that there is two ways of spelling that name. It's spelled with an A-G-E and an E-G-E. So which is correct? Not sure. He was one of the reporters for the South End, and this was his report in 1892 of total South End. So this wasn't just his farm. But he's reporting 30 tons of apples produced in the South End, 1892. So again, this is the peak of Salt Spring. About that time, Mr. Purdy was reporting for the North End, right around this area at Central, and he was reporting 15 tons from this area of Central here. It's amazing when you think about it. Looking at some of the actual production of apples in around the late 1800s, Henry Bullock, which is on is that Upper Ganges or Lower Ganges? Upper Ganges. Producing 2,000 to 3,000 boxes of apples, which at 40 pounds a box is an incredible amount of fruit. Mr. Lee, Ed Lee, in around Lee's Hill, 2,000. Mr. Trege, 2,400. And the Scott brothers producing, and in this case they produced a lot of plums. They produced 20 tons of plums, which they actually dehydrated in their evaporators. So that's an incredible amount of fruit. And what was happening, they were getting 2 to 4 cents a pound, which was pretty low. Labor, as we said, was always a difficulty. Whites and half-breeds in that period, 1892, were getting about $1.50 a day with room and board. Theodore Trege was trying to pay $1 a day, but he said it was hard to find, so maybe he wasn't paying enough. And Mr. Bullock, 50 cents a day for the Japanese. And Japanese laborers were scarce and expensive, but during winter they cost 75 cents per day and they boarded themselves. And I think one of the things we have to acknowledge here is the value and the importance of some of those Japanese workers here that helped. If you think of Ruckel Farm, where were the biggest trees growing? They were growing down in the bottom lands, which is now the present-day farmland. That's where you've got all those incredible trees you have to remove, and it was the Japanese workers that helped to get rid of those trees.
It seems to be functioning.
Okay, we seem to have it. Okay, sounds good. Okay, so this is Mr. Trege's farm, and right here is the bottom of Bridgman Road, which is just down from the Beaver Point Hall. If you go to Beaver Point and take a right, then that brings you down Bridgman, and then you get along here, and you come along Manhattan. And this is Russell Island here, this is Portland, and this is Moresby, and that's the last island in Canada. Everything else here is U.S. And this is another shot from his orchard, probably fairly young, because these trees here were fairly young. So he would be a commercial grower. In this case, the Starks were not a commercial grower. These were simply apples that they had for their own use. And this is Sylvia Stark. She was one of the, Stovey and Louie were one of the first pioneers around 1860 on Salt Spring. This is an incredible photograph from the Saanich Fair. This was a display of Salt Spring produce. And I've taken this one step further and taken some liberties and had an artist put some color to that. Because if you notice, all those fruits were displayed. They had display patterns on the fruit. And so that was amazing when you look at that. That was 1918. Now, this is the Ruckel Farm, 1908. And Lotus, who I had the great pleasure and luck to get to interview quite a bit, told me that this was a posed picture because the women at Ruckel did not pick. And again, these are the wives here of the first two Ruckels, Daniel and Alfred. Alfred, this is his wife. He's the one, he was the builder. So Alfred is the one that built that beautiful Queen Anne's house when you first come into Ruckel. And he was also one of the main builders of Beaver Point Hall, which happened about 1937. And there's an amazing story there that came via Lotus again. On Piers Island, just off Swartz Bay, used to be a prison, and the Dukhobors were housed there for some reason. And when they tore that down, Alfred, the builder, got all the windows to Ruckel, and he was going to probably do a greenhouse, but they needed them up at Beaver Point Hall. So all those beautiful windows you see in Beaver Point Hall all came from that prison on Piers Island. And if you look at Beaver Point Hall, you'll see all sorts of diagonal fir walls on the inside, and that's exactly the same type of wall as they have down in the Queen Anne's house and on Ruckel Farm. Quite amazing. Now, this is Jeff Scott here bringing in his apples in 1920. We'll have a picture. Oh, here we go. This is Will Scott's place. This is Fruitvale, which is out Long Harbor Road. And there's an interesting story here that originally this was the Louis Stark farm. But for some reason, the natives and the blacks did not get along well. And so what eventually happened is all the blacks moved to the interior of Salt Spring, leaving this sort of farm available. And so Louis bought that from the Starks. This is Anna and Henry Caldwell up in the north end, up near Walker Hook. And another black farmer up in there is Clark Wims. And it's interesting how that Bob Whedon lives on what is called Wims Farm up in that particular area. And this is on Bridgman Orchard, which is related to Nancy. This is the same farm as Traege had. So Theodore Traege's farm in 1860 went to the Bridgmans, and then from the Bridgmans it went to Corey Menhennick, which is where Lotus Ruckel was raised as a teenager. And then it is now in the family of the Beeches, which is Wavehill Farm. So that's been the traditional pattern of that. And in the early days when Traege bought this, he owned from the Beaver Point Hall. In fact, the 40-acre Beaver Point Hall Park was part of Traege's land. He owned right through to the Rock Salt restaurant. In fact, he owned the house right across the road that Bruce Patterson lives in. And Theodore Traege is buried just up Menhennick, just up Morningside, about, let's say, 20 houses. So he owned all that land, right over top of what we call Regina Hill. They also used to call that Traege Mountain, but anyway, that was apparently just a nickname. So this is down on the Bridgman property, and as near as we can figure out, the women actually did picking there. So these are related through to Nancy Braithwaite and to Bryony Penn.
My mother and my aunt are in that place.
Is that right? Which one, Nancy? Okay.
The one on the right.
The one
on
the right here?
The one on
Oh, my goodness. Fantastic. Isn't that nice? Thank you. The other thing you can see here is this photograph shows you putting apples into boxes, and that itself tells you that the apples were going to a higher level use than processing. So anytime they use boxes, those apples were going, hopefully, to be sold as eating apples. And so that's what they're doing here, is collecting them into. In this case, in the Monk Orchard, probably I would say in the 30s or 40s, the fact those are on the ground shows they're going into a processing system. And they were generally bagged, because bags were cheap, and I can't identify these two people, but I believe it's on the Monk Farm, which is down the bottom of King Road. At one point, apple boxes were worth 50 cents, and the apples, when you sold them, were worth about 70 cents. And so there was no reason to buy a box and only get the difference of 20 cents for the apples in the box. Now, this is down again on Traege's original farm, but this is at a time, 1945, when it was owned by Corey Menhennick. And this is a little log cabin down on Bridgman, and this was the cider house. So we'll talk a little bit more about Corey Manhenick's cider, because it's an amazing story. And these are Lotus Ruckel's two brothers here that are drinking some of the profits. This is a great view of Ganges, 1930s. What I want to show you now is up in here. That is all in behind the middle school and down on, I guess it's Park Road, in behind that. That was all orchard at one time, and this was owned by one of the Scots, I believe was Jeff Scott.
Frank
Scott. Okay, thank you. I always say that I learn a lot and I get more people feeding me information on one of these days, so that's good. Okay, Mowat Brother was doing a lot of shipping and consolidating, and so this is an ad from the Times Colonist, 1938, where they're looking for king apples. This was some plums being dried into prunes on Fruitvale, which is the Scott Orchard, the Will Scott Orchard. Oh, sorry, went on too far. This is some of the Japanese that helped on Mr. Bullock's farm, and I put this in as a tribute to those folk, all the folk like that, that were not being paid very much, and yet they helped make this into an incredible agricultural area. They worked hard. Chris Hadfield, down on his farm, which is Cushion Cove Farm, has done a lot of digging up in the old dumps down there, getting all the Chinese pottery and that out. And the Chinese, in his case, were working in an old lumber mill, but it shows you there's almost no history of those people being here. And so he's got some of the little history that exists about the ethnic folk that came here and helped make this island so good. I want to take a look at transportation, because it was one of the things that was difficult in the early days. But basically what happened was boats would call in. Before 1990, they'd call in once or twice a week at all these wharves. So the wharves became the real focus of transportation on Salt Spring. This is the Beaver Point Wharf, made by Henry Ruckel. And the only thing left there at this moment, if you're down at Ruckel, there's a bit of a cement foundation up in here for this house. But an incredible incredible story here. In the 20s, I think the mail came in twice a week here. And there's also a story about Bruce Patterson's grandfather being at night getting a flash of light from a boat here, which is probably a rum runner, and him coming out and giving the rum runner some gas to keep going. So some amazing stories. Anyways, this is something, this by the late 50s, this wharf was gone. This is a picture from the side of that same wharf. So in other words, there is a building out on the wharf here, and the house, the little store that they're running, is in here. This is the Burgoyne Bay Wharf. It's hard to imagine these days that there's enough activity to keep that going, but there was a lot of activity in those days up this wharf. This is Fulford Harbor. Again, it was quite an active place, 1905. This is the Joan. You hear about a lot about the Joan. It was a fair-sized boat, and this is approaching Vesuvius. What would seem to happen is the boats would come up one side or the other. So on one side they would do Vesuvius and Burgoyne. They come up the other side, they'd do Beaver Point, Ganges, Fernwood. Now this is a wharf that there's very little evidence of, but this is the Tregey Wharf, which is down right at the bottom of Bridgman Road, and this was gone by 1930. But it's interesting that Lotus and her family, Corey Manhenick was her stepfather, they arrived here by boat from Victoria with all their furniture on the end of this wharf, and then this was connected right through to Bridgman Road, and that's how they got their furniture onto Salt Spring. So that was quite an amazing thing. I had to throw this in because this is one of the first pictures of the Salt Spring Market. So we have Jesse Bond here, which is Malcolm Bond's father. We have Alan Hedger here, which is, I got to know him a little wee bit. We got a few good stories about him. And I never did know, but this apparently is Harvey Brundage. In the early days, the very early days, some of these pioneers, especially on the south end, used to actually row their produce to over to Sydney. And what I've got here is an account that Mr. Monk did of a one-day trip over to Sydney in his boat. In this case, he had a motor boat, so he wasn't rowing. But in the very early days, they were rowing back and forth. The other thing that happened, there was private wharf. So there was a wharf out on Fruitvale. Will Scott had a private wharf. And Bullock had their own private boat. So they actually looked after their own transportation. In about 1905, Malcolm and Purvis, and then later the Mowats got involved, and they started dealing with transportation. So that worked out quite all right, too. In 1915, there was a Beaver Point store right at the wharf at Beaver Point. And Musgrave Landing even had a private dock. It's hard to imagine that. There's so little going on at Musgrave these days, but the fact that there was a wharf there is amazing. 1902, the freight cost to Victoria and Nanaimo was $2.50 a ton, or 25 cents per package or per lamb. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Okay, we're going to flip a little bit more into modern things right now just to wind this slideshow up. This is a whip and tongue graph. This is how you would take a rootstock, being the size-controlling part of the tree, and attach it to a pencil-sized piece from the top of the tree that you want. And that's how you would get a grafted tree operating. And the whole thing is now that the sap has to flow across this root. So you want this thing to be attached very precisely. It's wrapped up in tape to make sure it doesn't dry out. And this is what it looks like when it's done. So that is pretty good. Once the grafts are done, I usually keep them for about a month in warm weather, and that's to callus or heal the wound, and then they go out about 1st of April or so. Our good old Salt Spring Apple Festival. This year we displayed a record 430 apple varieties, and I believe that's a record in Canada where I don't think anybody's displaying that many apple varieties, and they were all grown on Salt Spring and all grown organically. Again, some of the things we do here are these red flesh apples. This is called Pink Delight. And this gives you an example of diversity as well. All the different colors of apples that we grow here, different colors of flesh. And anything that's red also displays a red blossom. So the first sign you've got a red flesh tree is a red blossom. And about half of the red flesh trees also have red wood. So that's a good indication, too. If you're sending with red wood, you know it's going to have red flesh. We have some great artists here, and Amara Gabriel has done up these beautiful... these originally she did were huge paintings, and then she's put these into a little card. And then this is that poster I was showing you about, and I've just split it up to show you some of the apples. This is one I grow, for instance, so... Everybody here, this is one that grows on Mr. Purdy's, Mr. Raffles Augustus Robert Purdy. In fact, it's right near the barn on Bettis, the barn that sticks out, that tree. And I grab a couple of these every year for the Apple Festival because they're huge apples and they are such a good thing for display. They're the first thing that everybody notices in display. And Linda England, who runs Love My Kitchen, claims these are the best apples for baking. Okay, that's enough of the slideshow, so we'll get back to this talking here. Yeah, let's put the lights on. Oh, thank you. So, the importance of those wharfs in the early days cannot be understated. The other thing that's important is that when a boat arrived at those wharfs, it became a social event. People came out because it was exciting, and it was, you know, one of the highlights of the day. You'd be down to the wharf, and people would be dressed up. They'd dressed up in fine costumes, and it became a real event. So, quite an active. It would be one of the real treats if you could go back in time for any of us to be able to go and relive one of those boats coming into one of those wharfs.
That's when the mail came, too.
Yes. Yeah. You know, another neat story that Lotus told me was that in the early days, she moved to Salt Spring in 1920, and she lived on Corey's farm on Bridgman until about 29 when she got married. 1930 she got married. Anyways, apparently the mail came twice a week, but it was only delivered once, I think, on the Tuesday. She would ride down bareback on her horse from Bridgman down to Ruckel to pick up the mail. And, you know, I can't imagine Lotus. I knew her as a, you know, really sophisticated lady, but her riding down bareback to Ruckel Park. And one of the other stories she always told me on the Thursday when she was down there, she said, "I can't believe it, but every time I went down there, Gordon was there to help me off the horse," and she didn't know what the coincidence was. She married him, and she said, "He was always there to help me get off the horse." It was quite the story. Okay, just trying to pull this all together. In about 1895, the population of Salt Spring was estimated about 450 people, consisting of 62 married couples. So that was ...1903... they started a daily fruit train that went all the way from Victoria to Winnipeg. So again, that was one of the real good ways of getting fruit spread out to the different parts of the country. As I said earlier, Ruckel's 1930 started pulling out some of the fruit trees because the market had fallen away for that. And I'll talk about a lot of, in those days, a lot of that fruit would go into processing. So when you sell it into processing, you're not making as much as if you're selling it into fresh eating. The Ruckels at that point started creating seed potatoes for the Sebago potato, which is one of the things that they were growing seed for the Sebago down on Ruckel. Okay, so let's take a wander back here and we'll take a look at some of these things here. As I said, probably the very first presence of agriculture was in about 1860, Jonathan Begg, who was only on Salt Spring a very few years, but he actually started a nursery, and so he was one of the ones supplying fruit trees in the early 1860s, and I could never understand. I knew he didn't have time to grow them himself, but I found out later that he was sourcing those from established nurseries in California and Oregon. But even then, you can imagine how difficult it was to get those things up here. Just amazing. Then we had Theodore Trege, who apparently searched out the whole island, checking out the soil on all the island, and settled on that place in the south as the best. He apparently was quite sick, and it was a native woman that nursed him back to health, and he married her, and that was one of the best things he did. Sylvia Stark, as I said, they initially started out on Long Harbor on Fruitvale and then moved into the interior up to a road now that's named after them, Stark Road. They were a good example of a homestead orchard. And then the Bettis Orchard was right down at Bettis Beach, and that's an interesting concept there. What they did is they actually had apples with them when they first came here, and they planted the apple seeds. The apple seeds grew, and that's what they used for rootstock. So the following year, they had a bunch of scions. Scions are the pencil-sized piece of wood that you graft with. They had a bunch of scions sent from Ireland, and they were then ready to graft their scions onto the seed-grown rootstock that they'd created the year before. So that was quite interesting. Mary England tells a great story that about 1880, her father, which was Raffles Augustus Robert Purdy, I love that name, he saw a sign in London, England, that said, "Come to the new land," which was British Columbia. "Tickle the soil with a spade, and it smiles with the harvest." And so he got here in 1884, and he bought about 125 acres of land there, which most of the family still lives on. He planted about 1,000 fruit trees, and we had them in the Apple Festival 2 years ago, and hopefully they'll be in again.
Harry?
Yeah?
You wouldn't believe how those fruit tree scions got here.
No.
Came in apples. The apples?
Oh, yes.
In potatoes.
Yes, good point. Yeah. That was interesting. The scions coming from Ireland, people were so smart in those days. They just took the piece of wood, shoved it into a potato, and that kept it moist for the trip here. Thank you. That was great. Okay, let's flip over to cider now. Because I didn't realize it until I started talking to a few people from those days that in the 1920s, there wasn't a lot of money to be had here, and cider was one of the main things that kept food on the table of all those farmers. So Corey Manhenick, who lived on Theodore Trege's old land, was one of apparently the best cider makers on Salt Spring, and he was also a mining engineer, so he would work up in the Trout Lake area of British Columbia as a mining engineer, but the story was he always came home at the time when the gravenstein's ready to be harvested. His gravenstein's were his favorite apple for cider. And Lotus in the 20s used to be the one that helped throw the apples into his grinder. It was a hand grinder and a hand press. So, I mean, a lot of work to make that cider. He had apparently 20 oak barrels that he filled, and that was his cider. He apparently cider sold for 75 cents a gallon, and you can imagine the middle of the winter when there was no other produce for sale, that would bring in a little bit of money that would keep food on the table. In the 30s, cider parties were very popular on the island. It was a gathering place, and so I'm sure there were lots of gatherings down at that Manhenick cider place that you saw. Prohibition was in effect in 1924, so that created a bit of a problem because it then became illegal to sell cider. So you couldn't sell cider with more than 8% alcohol, but most of the Salt Spring cider was up around 11%. So they figured that someone must have squealed somehow, because at one point, Mr. Purdy, Mr. Rogers on the Cranberry, and Manhenick's all got fined, and they got fined $400, which is an outrageous amount of money in those days. But apparently, according to the story here, Gavin Mowat helped get that fine to disappear. So, I don't know. Interesting story. That was that incident about them getting fined was very embarrassing to Lotus, because she was going up to high school at the time, and here, her stepfather had just been fined for selling cider. There's one interesting story, is Don Fraser, Lotus's brother, decided he wanted to do a subdivision down in that area around Manhenick, and sold off all the land that's now Manhenick, made no money, cut down the gravenstein tree, so Lotus was never happy about the fact there was no money to be made from all that land. Okay, let's take a look at some of the, I call them short anecdotes. In the 20s, when many fruit trees were being removed, companies such as the Empress Manufactured required apples for jellies and a filler for many varieties of jams. So they took 40 to 50 tons of apples each year. And another place then was Vickers and the Sydney Canning Company, which ceased production in 1920. So again, when those were going, at least they were buying, maybe not getting much for apples, but at least you had a source. So once those manufacturers went out of business, that made it much more difficult. In 1894, fruit trees outnumbered Salt Spring residents by 10 to 1. So there's roughly 450 residents and about 4,600 apple trees. So that's quite a record. I'm not sure what they're at now. So as I said, the Okanagan came in the 20s once they got irrigation. And I still believe that the non-irrigated tree produces a much better tasting apple anyway. The biggest apple grown on Salt Spring was the Gloria Monday, which weighed 24 ounces, and it could be up to 5 inches across. Now, the Bietenheimer, which is grown on the Purdy farm, is a big one also. In the 1920s and 30s, local farmers sometimes couldn't pay for their stay at the hospital or their doctors, and so what they would do, they would barter with food, and that way they got at least to pay for their medical services. The 1915 Fall Fair had prizes for 24 different kinds of apples. If you look at what we're at now, I think we have prizes for maybe 8 varieties of apples. So, you know, there was prizes for quite a bit. 1917, they had prizes for 27 different types of apples. So even the diversity of our fall fair has shrunk. I got a neat story which I personally heard from Alan Hedger. He was quite a character, and he was one of the original marketeers down at our Salt Spring Market. They were talking about the Ben Davis apple. The Ben Davis was not necessarily a very good apple, but it would keep well. So we have to think like a pioneer. If you were a pioneer in March and you had a Ben Davis, you didn't care that it tasted good. It was an apple, and it got you through to the summer till something else was available. So Mr. Hedger always said, and he had a wry sense of humor and just a hint of a smile when he said this. He always said, the Ben Davis was as good in March as it was in October. Of course, it wasn't very good in October either. And then Gwen Ruckel always told the story about having sent, and I don't know who sent it, I don't think it was off Ruckel, they sent a load of Ben Davis apples to Australia where it was rejected and sent back to Canada and arrived in exactly the same condition when it had been sent. So that was an apple that was like a Teflon. The one interesting story, though, however, is that the Ben Davis was one of the apples that they used to create Cortland. So that's an idea how you those genes, just because they're coming from an apple that's maybe not that good, can become something better. So next time you eat a Cortland, which we don't see much on Salt Spring, we see a few of them, that's got Ben Davis genes in it. Lotus also told me that they had an apple tree down on Corey Manhennick's farm on Bridgman that was called the Blue Pearmain. And Lotus always called it Pearmain, so I have to call it like Lotus did, Pearmain. So that apple they treasured so much, they wouldn't even sell those to their neighbors, which were the Bridgmans. They kept them all for themselves. And it is an apple that has a beautiful blue blush on it. It looks blue when it's on the tree, like a steel blue. According to Harry Baptie, he met his wife Margaret Monk at the Manhennick Cider House. Margaret Monk used to assemble apple boxes for her father. So those apple boxes they used in the old days came as a package where the pieces weren't put together and then everybody had to put them together. Ted Dodds would also assemble apple boxes for his father. And Empress Jam Company from Victoria would also bring over a trunk and pay $1 per box for grounders. So you could sell a box for $2. It was good apples, but it was only half of that if they were grounders. Another one that put boxes to was David Weatherall. He was a pioneer, not a pioneer, but he had relatives here, the Scots, and he used to put apple boxes together. Okay, so let's shift to the next one. Okay, what I've got here is a one-day journey by Mr. Monk, and this was on April 25th, 1918. So in other words, this would be towards the end of the apple season, but he still had some apples left, and what he was doing is taking them over to Sydney to sell them. The nice thing about this is it's very detailed, and it also tells me what he was buying. So we have an idea of the relative value of what he was buying. So basically, he leaves at 5:30 p.m. in his boat for Sydney. He's got 10 boxes of apples, and he gets there at 7 p.m. He's running without his magneto because he's just running on the battery, so that's a chance, you know, to go all that far without having a magneto. Anyways, he left Sydney at 8 p.m. and anchored in North Sydney and walked back to Sydney by the road, and he stayed overnight at a place there for $1.50. So he's only getting $2 a box for apples. He has 7 boxes, and he is very detailed. He tells me exactly what type of apples and who bought it. So he had 7 boxes of Kings, number one Kings, bought by a person called Metro, and he got $14 for it. So the nice thing about that is you know exactly what he's getting. Number two Kings, he's only getting $1.50, and number three Kings, he's getting $1.25 a box. Now the interesting thing is what he's buying. So one piece of back bacon, he's paying $1.70, which is almost a box of apples. You know. Now if you want to merely make that applicable, then, you know, I sell a box of apples for about $100, 40 pounds apples, $100. So he's paying a good percentage of $100 for back bacon, 4 packages of raisins for 50 cents, and 4 cakes of maple syrup for 57 cents. He's buying his turnip seeds for 50 cents and his carrot seeds for 35. He buys a pair of boots for $7.50 for himself, and he buys a pair of boots for his daughter for $4. So again, $4 is 2 boxes of apples, which if you look at that, you know, and I translate to modern times, that's $200. So, wow, you know why these people were not making very much money. The other thing that he bought from his other records here is $1 for a cord of wood. So now we're paying $300 plus, I guess, for that. So half a box of apples bought him a cord of wood in those days. So that's one case where he maybe was getting a better deal than we get nowadays. The other thing that I'm lucky enough to have for Mr. Monk, and I won't go over it, but I have the complete farm records for about 3 years, which tell every detail of what he sold, etc., what he bought. So that's quite amazing. He was, for instance, again, two bucks a box for apples. He was buying hens at $1.50 each. So again, 3/4 of a box of apples for a hen. And a duck was $2, so that would be a box of apples for a duck. And a hog was $5, so that would be 2.5 boxes of apples for a hog. So life wasn't easy, and as they say in those things there, all we lack is money and the time to enjoy it. So I think that's enough detail for now. Any questions?
they had an apple train in the early 20th century that went from Victoria to Winnipeg.
Yep.
Did they put the rail cars on a ferry?
They must do it. They do the same now, but I'm not sure. That would be an interesting fact. They must have had that, yeah, that same sort of thing they have now. C-SPAN has one sitting right off the Swartz Bay. Yeah, they must have to.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
Canadian National Railways ran a ferry called the Kenora. It was actually commissioned by the Canadian Northern Railway, which became part of CN. And it started running, I believe, about 1910. And it ran from Victoria into Vancouver.
Wow.
It actually just pushed the rail cars onto the boat. Off it went. Same thing coming back.
Okay. 1910.
The dock is, I think it's called the Bay Street Bridge. And the dock was just on the seaward side of the Bay Street Bridge, where the old Point Hope Shipyard was.
Oh, wow.
Down in there.
And so they were going all the way from the harbor of Victoria to the harbor of Vancouver.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Neat.